Previously on Floating Space.
Deputy Mayor for Communities and Social Justice, Dr. Debbie Weeks-Bernard.
Often in London, those who are most likely to need help are least likely to ask for it.
And she basically describes gentrification of third places.
I think more could be done in terms of recognising nightlife for the service that it provides.
My theory of the conduit is you have to have a founding genome and you have to have a founding ethos.
Welcome back to Floating Space Live. We are very lucky to be joined by journalist, social commentator, founder of Strangers in the City, Shante Joseph.
For myself, like, yes.
Yes.
See that video, the interview where Oprah's interviewing Beyonce and she's like, you are Beyonce. And she's like, thank you.
This is what we're channeling right now. Thank you. So let me start with my first question. Do you have a third place?
Oh, this is a really good one. I think I have multiple third places. Obviously, in some ways, Strangers in the City, that I'm sure we'll talk about, is a third place. I have recently kind of started a coup in my run club, and I have taken it over. It was a hostile takeover. And so that is like, we meet every Saturday, you know, and it's not really too chaotic. It's not like any of these intense run clubs. We just like meet every Saturday, same place, do a run together, hang out afterwards a little bit, have some coffee. And then I would also definitely say the gym, but I don't really socialize in the gym that much, but I am definitely a class person. So I've been doing pole dance for 6 years and I've recently started going to a studio near me. And that's really starting to feel like a bit of a third space to me. And in fact, one of the girls that I met at my first class there came to the bouldering event that we hosted as well.
Oh, so, that's so nice.
Yeah, I met her and I was like, oh, you're great. And so, yeah, that was good too.
What a full circle moment. That's so sweet. So I have read your articles and you've written a lot about independence and also loneliness and kind of how the two go hand in hand. So I just wanted to kind of get your take on what you think the roots of loneliness, at least in this moment in time, really stem from.
Yeah. So one thing I write about a lot is like this sort of like crisis of connection and this idea that I don't think people are necessarily lonely because they don't have places to go or then they're completely isolated, especially not in a place like London. Like I am constantly surrounded by people. I don't want to be, but like I am. So I never feel alone. But I think loneliness is this feeling of like not truly being understood or not feeling seen. And I think we are not connecting with people. And so we're feeling quite lonely because we're not being observed for who we are, so we don't feel very real. And I think that is what like this like loneliness crisis comes from, and of course it's influenced by so many things, I guess, just like being super online and keeping up a facade and like always thinking about the image that you're projecting to the world as opposed to just being who you are, and all of your friendships becoming quite virtual, and that feeling of, you know, if I watch your story I feel like I've hung out with you, so I don't feel the need to like pressure you to hang out or call you and whatnot. And so I think in some ways all of the things that made our relationships feel quite solid, the kind of like, as you said before, the inconvenience like doesn't really exist anymore. And so I think we're feeling more and more lonely because of that.
It's like a false positive connection where it appears that way, but actually there's been a big barrier. And I think tech is a really good one to talk about because, you know, one of the episodes was about being online and how definitely in some communities, especially gaming communities, have like super intense relationships with each other because of how much time they're talking and being around each other. But also, you don't leave your house and then you don't see anyone for weeks on end. And so there is this kind of technological barrier. How do you confront that? Because you're also a very online person, but you're also a very people person. So how do you merge the two worlds and come out as a sane person?
The tech thing is really interesting, though. Even on that gaming point, like my little brother, you know, he used to have a Nintendo Switch and then he got into like gaming online. And that is like, it's so interesting observing him in that space, because in some ways that is like his social circle. Do you know what I mean? Outside of who he goes to school with, it's like playing with these people online that he doesn't actually know. But they like do spend like somewhat like quality time together. Like he would.
They know each other so well.
And like they, I remember one time they all like logged on the game. I sound so old. Oh my god. They all like logged on the game at the same time, and they were and they it's this like dinosaur game that he plays, and they made like almost this short mini documentary. It was just so insane, like what the kids are up to online now, and just how like they're drawing this sense of like working together. You know, everyone has to be here at the same time. Everyone has a different role. Someone did the voiceover. Someone did the editing. So it was like it was so crazy. But like, yeah, that's kind of his space online now, and it's really interesting to observe that change.
Proper community building.
Yeah, it was. It's so. But he is like, how old is he? Like 15. Like so interesting to see. Like that is what his kind of space looks like now. But I think for me, yeah, I am like super online. Like definitely too online at points, and in some ways. I think there used to be a point, I remember seeing like some really funny meme about this, but like back in the days, I think Twitter used to be a really kind of fun place where it was like different communities. It kind of like, it wasn't run by Elon Musk, so it wasn't a horrible place to be.
Yeah.
But I remember making so many friends online, making so many friends, particularly on Twitter, in activist circles, in journalism circles, being in so many different groups. And it was just like, oh, okay, this is like somewhat of a community, especially amongst like black journalists. There were loads of like international black journalist groups that we would all be in, and we'd exchange details for editors, or where we've pitched, or, you know, who has good rates or who doesn't pay on time. And like, it became this way for us to kind of support each other virtually. And I think now online doesn't have that same feeling to it. It almost kind of feels like there is this like performance of community and being there for people. And I think, I mean, I don't know if this is controversial to say, but like the networks that we used to have online that were just things we did to help each other are now behind a paywall on Substack. Do you know what I mean? Like, whereas before it would just be like, oh, here's some people pitching things and we'd all send it to each other. It's like, oh, you need to sign up and you need to pay $5.99 a month. So when you talk about like the sort of like commercialization of community and stuff like that, I also think about that also happening in the digital space as well. But it is really interesting. And I have found it difficult at times to balance it. And this is partly why I was like, I need to start something that feels IRL. This is what I do. This is who I am. And I'm losing myself in being only online. I kind of feel like I am performing, and I am like giving this idea that I'm close to my audience, but I'm not actually kind of connecting to them in a meaningful way.
So what's that bridge then? What does it take for you to meet someone or have this conversation online and then for a stranger to become a friend?
I think it's really hard these days, you know. I think it used to be so much easier before, just people you would always be online with and communicate with, you'd then see them in spaces. I think like Black London is like really small, and so it's like when people talk about like Black Twitter, but like Black UK Twitter, it's always the kind of the same faces, and then we'd all go to the same events and we'd all be at the same things, and before you knew it, you had this kind of community of people that you only knew from online that you have IRL. And I think nowadays it feels harder to do just because it feels increasingly hostile online. And whereas before people were just there because they had interesting things to say, all of these platforms are now monetized by engagement. And so I think there's an inauthenticity in the way that we communicate with each other online, because now we know everyone's doing it to get paid. Do you know what I mean? Whereas before it was just like a thing that we did. But I think I've now gone back to really trying to meet people IRL and like connect with people IRL and like understand what is it that I find really interesting about this person. Like last year I did a Portuguese course just randomly. Like I just love Brazil, and I went to Brazil like 3 years ago before everyone was going to Brazil. Like no one even knew what Brazil was before I went there, but okay. And I remember like the first day of this course, like going into the class and meeting this girl, her name is Fiola, and like I love her down. Like the moment I met her, I was like, I just know we're going to be friends. And even though we both don't do that course anymore, we still speak like every day. I see her all the time. I talk to her all the time. And she's a friend that I made last year who I'm like obsessed with. I think she's amazing. And I just think like I'm now getting to this point now where I'm like, hey, let me just go to places and do things and try new things, because you just never know who you're going to come across.
So it's again this thing of bravery, right? Mm-hmm. It's just putting yourself out there, being comfortable, being uncomfortable. And is that the inspiration for Strangers in the City? Actually, can you just give a little overview of what Strangers in the City is?
Yeah, so I run an event series with Zainab over there, wave your hands in the air. Let people know you are. And we run an event series across London. It's called Strangers in the City. And we have one rule for all of our events. You have to come by yourself. Like, you're not allowed to come with your boyfriend. You're not allowed to come with your best friend. You're not allowed to come with your coworker. Everyone has to be by themselves. Because we wanted to create a space where there was a very low kind of barrier to making connections. So you didn't have to do the work of having to infiltrate into an already pre-existing relationship. Like, if you go to a Pilates class, there'll be people who've been going there for, like, you know, 6 years, and they know the instructor, and you get in there and it feels really awkward, and you're having to navigate being a new person in this space and maybe trying something new and then having to kind of like mosey your way on in into someone else's conversation. It's a lot of work. And I realize, I just think, it's not that we don't have a lot of spaces to go to, so spaces aren't designed for us to really connect with each other. And so when we started Strangers in the City, we said, we're going to do random things. Like, we've done improv, trampolining, baking, we've done, you know, disorganized fun, like crazy quiz nights. And then we also do like aerial skills and like, there's just going to the theater. We do all sorts of stuff. It's like a way for people to discover their city, but also to connect with new people. And we're very intentional about how we create our events. Like, from the moment you walk in, there is some sort of icebreaker, be it a getting to know you bingo, or we've worked with a startup called Chatty Elephants, where every single person has a puzzle piece and you need to find and communicate with other people to put together this puzzle. When we did it for our first birthday, we did dinner with 100 strangers. We had 100 puzzle pieces. So every single person in the space had a purpose, and they were needed and they were necessary. And in our events, we were just obsessed with creating a space where people felt like they belonged. This wouldn't work without them being here and participating. If there was 99, you know, if there were 100 people and only 99 puzzles, like, one person wouldn't be needed, but we needed everyone to have a role. And so, yeah, we kind of create these events all over London. We design the agendas in a way that are centered on connection. And yeah, we just tell people to come alone. And we've been doing it for just over a year now. We've done over 25 events, and it's like, we're just still growing and scaling.
I went to one of your events a couple of weeks ago. We went to bouldering down in Croydon, and I discovered the tram for the first time, which was so exciting. And I think what I was struck by when I arrived was, it was exactly as you said, everybody had a purpose, but the purpose was to have fun. The purpose was, you know that no one else knows each other. You know that if you say, hey, what's your name? Or like really put yourself out there, you're going to be received and not palmed off. And nobody is, why would you go there if you weren't there to make friends, you know? And so I think that was a really nice atmosphere to be around. And that thing that you've just said of purpose, when you're in a place and you have something to do, you feel important and you feel like you belong. And giving someone, I think it made me think of third places as like, oh, maybe it's just this concept of being somewhere to have a purpose, to belong. And it, as you say, with Strangers in the City, it doesn't have to be the same place. Maybe it's a moving circus kind of place. And that's really special. So you said to me earlier, it's not a community, but it's a chance to get out of your comfort zone and be a stranger. So can you tell me a bit more about that, of why it's not that?
Because I think, people come back to our events, right? But the ethos is still the same. Even if you've been before and you recognize someone from the event, you have to just give yourself into the process of connecting and meeting with new people. We don't want people to kind of come in, see people they know, already feel connected, and then it's like awkward for new people entering the space. And so we wanted to keep the idea of like novelty. And for me, I guess like Strangers in the City took shape because there are so many things that I've done, whether it's like aerial or, you know, pole or whatever. Like, I have so many interests, and I often have people being like, oh, I really want to try this, but none of my friends want to do it. I'm too scared to do it by myself. There were kind of all these stipulations, and it helped me think about, okay, what is a space where people can try the things they've always wanted to do and they don't have to worry about this very awkward social element to it. And so like, that's kind of how we came up with this concept. And so you know, even if you do come again and you do see people you know, you still have to take part in the games and the activities. And we often in our events have people in teams and we're doing quizzes. And when we do a dinner, we make everyone get up and switch seats before the last course. And so there's no kind of sitting and being comfortable. And you will always meet new people. That is the kind of the idea. And I think I shied away from being like, oh, it's a community, because actually it's like a group of strangers just coming together and trying something new and meeting new people. And there's no sort of regularity in terms of like where it is and what it is. It's just the only thing that's regular is that no one knows each other and you have to just put in effort to get to know people around you.
It's like a fantastic springboard.
Yeah.
Do you think that people are so focused on this word community? As I said earlier, like brands hijacking the word and it being thrown out in all sorts of places, that people forget that it's actually a one-person process of like it just takes one and then it takes another one and then it takes another one, yeah. And that it's so focused on this broader picture than what the reality is.
Yeah, and I think that's like it is. I think that sometimes like ruins the kind of pursuit of community when you kind of look at it as this thing where I need to be in this place where loads of other people are in this place and we're always here and it's just us, and it kind of feels a bit like exclusionary as opposed to this is a chance for you to discover. And the thing with Strange in the City is that like you might come to an event and for the icebreaker you might be partnered with someone and you can't stand them, and that's okay. Like we need to normalize that you're not going to get along with everyone all the time, but it's important to know that in about 20 minutes time, you're going to be in a different group, or you're going to be doing a different thing, or you're going to be sat somewhere else. And so I think it's the idea of like, oh, you don't have to come here and feel like you're saddled to this one thing. There is an element of discovery even within the event itself. And so I think, yeah, I think this idea of like like being obsessed with community and feeling like things have to be one particular way does a disservice to the process of helping people get to know others.
And it's this thing of sitting in discomfort, right? It's accepting who you are in a space and who you are to other people and them accepting all of that as well. Do you think London is a great place for that or a difficult place for that?
It's tough. I think like London is obviously good because there is so much to do, but I don't always think it can be inviting and warm and friendly. And I think a lot of spaces operate under the assumption that you're already going to know these people or you're going to be able to gel in this space really, really well. But I just think there isn't a lot of work done to help ease people into new things. I think people who are already very social and extroverted will continue to be like that. And then people who aren't will really struggle because there's no sort of like nice middle ground to help you get in the door. And I think that's what Strangers in the City tries to account for. It doesn't matter how confident or shy you are. The event is built in a way that everybody can come in and participate and it doesn't feel daunting because we've done all of the thinking for how you connect, and so you just have to exist in the space.
Yeah, so it's an infrastructure issue and the actual process of thinking through from beginning to end, how is someone going to move through this space? How is someone perhaps going to react or be able to interact? Yeah, yeah. And so one of the things that we spoke about with Debbie as well was cost. Yeah. And things are so expensive. It's hard. It's hard to put yourself out there constantly, not just mentally, but financially. Yeah. And so sometimes I do feel like you're absolutely right. There's so much going on in London, but it is constantly putting yourself out there with strangers. And so I do appreciate that Strangers in the City, you can come back, you can meet new people, but it's this sort of more safe space. But there's a cost. Mm-hmm. There's always a cost. How do you manage that balance?
So yeah, I think it's quite tough. I mean, when we first started Strange in the City, we were kind of just working already with studios. I think we did pottery, we did aerial, we did pole, and these were all spaces that I had already worked with before. So they were kind of like, they gave us like really discounted like tickets, and I kind of just like begged them. I was like, can you just do me a deal? Because for me, it was like, I just kind of want to put this event on. We didn't make any money from it. It's always kind of been a bit of a loss, and it's only now kind of slowly changing. But for me, it was just like, I just want to put this on. I want to see if this concept really works. And then now when we kind of work with studios, you know, they might charge like regularly like £30 £10 for a class, but then they'll give it to us like cheaper, so then we can offer it to people cheaper, because obviously we design a whole experience around the event itself. And so I think, yeah, it's obviously tough because there are still costs in that way. But we're trying to explore doing more kind of free events or really cheap events, like be it quiz nights and stuff like that. So there's always something for people to come to. But then also it's like when people are involved, we obviously want to pay them. Like when we did like Samba, for example, so we had to like pay the Samba tutor, pay for the studio and stuff like that. And so in that way, it can make things expensive, but we always try to think, okay, how do we make this event cheaper, or how do we give people more value? Like, is it that, you know, I obviously like have a social platform and I've done, you know, content creation. So I have connections to all these like PR companies and brands, and, you know, I'll just be sending out email blasts every day begging everyone, can you send us stuff? I'll make content about it just so everyone can leave the event and have goodie bags and snacks. And
the goodie bag was great,
right?
The goodie bag was great.
I really think about that. I think about that a lot. I think about how can I leverage the things that I have to make this experience feel worthwhile for people who have, you know, decided to come and be a part of it. So, but yeah, I agree. Like the cost thing is crazy, but it's just things in London are just super, super expensive anyway. But I'm always trying to think about what I can do, who I can speak to, who I can promise what to, in order to like make things free or make things cheap. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I really appreciated when you said like knowing what it takes to part with your money to do something. Yeah. And that is really important, I think, especially, and what you're doing is great. And I had a great time when I came as well. So to wrap things up, do you have any hopes for the future, and what are you looking to do going forward?
So yeah, I mean, obviously we just want to keep growing Strange in the City. We have a whole bunch of events coming up for November and some for December. We have one tomorrow. We have ring making in Woolwich, and we're kind of just like experimenting, trying new things, discovering new places across London, working with more studios and practitioners, and just trying to give people a way to like discover and understand their city, but also feel like this is a space where you can potentially make new friends. You know, like it's so lovely when we put on events and then people connect and then they hang out afterwards and they tag us in things, or they, you know, make a group chat on the day and then they go, and like that is the stuff that I want to see. Like I just want to be a facilitator of friendships and connections, and you know, whatever happens afterwards, but I'm glad that I could be a part of that.
And thank you for doing it as well. You and Zainab have done such an amazing job so far, and I can't wait to hear about the events going forward. So a big thank you to Shante. So we are now at the final part of the night. I put out a call out a few months ago for audio pieces about third places. And I was really overwhelmed and touched that people put the time and effort into sharing the places that they love. And they are from London, Bristol, Brooklyn, New York, Jeonju, South Korea, and Bangkok, Thailand. So to start us off here in London, we have Mario's Cafe by Ivan Dabwan. Mario's is in Kentish Town, which has long been a place of gathering for the local community and people in the know. Ivan says, "You never feel like the next customer paying for a service because Mario has created an environment where everyone feels like they are themselves and contributing in a small way to the space." This is Mario's Cafe.
Hi, Chase. Right now, I'm going to help this young man do an interview. So
that's
he's doing a project. So that's why. Otherwise, I would have made you a coffee, Adam. We'll speak again. Take care.
Let's do this, man. I'll just sort of like speak off the cuff. So my grandfather, he purchased this place. It was like a lockup. This is in 1958. You know, I knew this place existed, but I knew it was rented out. And then around 1985, the Chinese family that were renting it out decided to leave it. So it's derelict for a while. So while it was derelict, so this was the period between 1985 and 1989, my dad was made redundant in 1988. My grandfather passed away in 1988, and then so his brothers and sisters had this property. Obviously my dad owned a fifth of it, and they were going to sell it, and then my dad said, well look, I've been made redundant, why don't I just why don't you rent it to me and I'll reopen it as a cafe like we used to have. So my dad decided at the age of 58, goes, right, I'm going to open it as a cafe. At this point, I was 21, unemployed. My dad kind of asked me to help him out. So we were all dead against it. Me, my mum and my sisters were like, well, don't bother opening it. Just sell it. Take your cut. And that's it. Be done with it. And he was like, no, let's just reopen. I'm going to reopen it as a calf. You know, I'm going to give it another go. You can come and help me. I'll call it Mario's Calf. I'll call it after you. And I was like, oh, gee. I goes, look, Dad, you know, to be honest with you, I don't mind helping you out, but I'm not going to get roped into being there. You know, I'm not really interested in catering. You know, I'll do it for a little while. And when you're up and running, you know, count me out. What did you have for breakfast? I was front of house. My dad was the chef. So we were getting loads of musos. And I was kind of really connecting with them and all the students. And so I just started enjoying it. Still with the intention of probably leaving my dad to it. But then my dad ended up having a heart attack during that first year, so it was like shit. So he had to go off, he went to have his bypass, and I was just left holding the baby, so to speak. And you know, then 5 years became 10 years, and then 10 years became 20 years. Here I am now, like, you know, 35 years later.
Thank you, Ivan, who is somewhere in the crowd. Next, we have Anna Maria Woodrow exploring their memories of drifting through Bangkok shopping centres whilst dreaming of musical spaces in London to belong in.
Really, what we would do, and this is every expat teenager in Bangkok, you'd just go to Emporium, hang out in the air conditioning, go and look at the bookstore, have some food, maybe go to the cinema, get some frozen yoghurt. If it was a cool evening in rainy season, you could just about get away with sitting in Benjaseri Park. Most of the time, that was kind of impossible. It was too hot. These are all the things I remember about Emporium. A weird escalator that was attached to the concourse of the SkyTrain, and then you'd go up, and then to the right, there was some kind of shoe shop. Up ahead, there was a called Greyhound Cafe, which had very peppery food. On the fifth floor was the cinema. On that same level, there was a Starbucks. There was a Thai tea, there was bubble tea in the basement, there was a sort of food court, there was Asia Books, there was Kinokuniya, Japanese bookshop. And I remember walking around there after school listening to Had $10 by Cherry Glazer over and over again, and being really angsty at the fact that everything around me was just kind of luxury shopping, and wanting to find stuff that wasn't that, but it was hard. There is a comfort to it. I do feel nostalgic for these sterile chain places within a built-up air-conditioned environment. It's why I like taking the DLR through Canary Wharf so much, because it really reminds me of the SkyTrain through Bangkok. There was one record shop, actually, in Tong Lo, which maybe on, it was on, like, Soi 47, and I would walk to it and get really, really hot. It would take about half an hour to walk to it, maybe more, dodging motorbikes. It was Joy Division-themed. It was called 1979 Vinyl and Unknown Pleasures, and I didn't have a record player. Still don't. I went to that record store a lot and just looked at things. I think I only actually bought two things there. A Secret Santa gift for my best friend, who was also into music, a CD of Yo La Tengo, I Can Hear the Heart Beating as One. Yo La Tengo were one of the only bands in my 8 years of growing up in Thailand that actually came and played in Bangkok. 4th of December 2016, my journal entry from the time of them coming.
I loved it. Anything that loud. Ira is amazing, haha. Yo La Tengo were very good, indeed. Yeah, deeper into movies. I would listen to Yo La Tengo until my ears bleed and my brain turns.
Still got the ticket stub. On the page next to it is me counting down the months that remained until I moved back to the UK so that I could go and see bands and maybe be in a band one day. Anyway, I live in London now and all of the small venues are threatening closure. You know, I've played at the George, I've played at the Windmill. I've got to remember that 10 years ago, that was where I wanted to be. It's where I have to be.
Thank you, Anna Maria, for sharing the tension between longing and being. I think I've definitely felt that a few times myself. Next is Flatbush Gardener by Lynn Ehrman in Brooklyn, New York. This piece visits an urban gardener describing how he's created a third space for fellow species.
There's some goldenrod starting to do something. Irises in this bed.
There's native iris.
Mountain mint. Pollinator plants. Very diverse visitors. What did I just saw? Oh, yeah, there's evening primrose. There's a primrose moth, which pollinates at night. Generally don't see it during the day. There's caterpillars that specialize on evening primrose. There's a couple other. You're like, okay, something else will seem to prefer want this. Are they even still around anymore? You know, here in Brooklyn. Will they show up? And that out here working in the garden. And I noticed a butterfly visiting the pipevine. And I noticed it was curling its abdomen under the leaves as it landed. And I figured, oh, maybe it's laying eggs. And so I kept track of where it was landing. And when it was gone, so I wouldn't spook it, I went up and I found the eggs. And so I was able to track them from... It's so brilliant, just brilliant yellow and black against this pure white flower. It was very striking. So... And it's a fairly large-sized fly. It's not a small species.
It's just like sawdust, almost.
Or it is sawdust at this point. And that's mostly from rot, but also from organisms eating the dead wood, the detritivores. Then there's the nesters. So the small green, the pure green sweat bee, nests in these logs. And this is a reliable place for me to come and look for them when they're active. And I don't recall where things show up that are just odd. It's almost like they know this is a place where they'll be respected and looked after and cared for.
Just the thought of other species escaping the capitalist grind to have to find somewhere to socialize and be is the sweetest thing in the world to me. Thank you, Lynn, for sharing that. Next is Cafes by Angela Min in Jeonju, South Korea.
I love a good cafe, but to be honest, they never really felt like a viable third place for me. Which sounds silly because, in theory, cafes are amazing candidates for third places, right? You can meet fairly freely, inexpensively, and frequently. But the one factor that made it kind of impossible for cafes to be my third place was opening times. At least where I used to live, cafes would close up around 5 or 6pm. And I'm someone who wants to go to my third place well after the working day is done, probably around 8pm or something like that. So cafes were kind of impossible, which was a shame because I, like many others, love them. However, that completely changed when, 7 months ago, I moved to South Korea. Now, I couldn't imagine cafes not being my third place. I was thinking about singling one or two out, but the fact is they're all so amazing that it feels a bit impossible to. And the main reason that they now qualify as a third place is cafes are open until 11pm, which is wild. I often go from about 8 till 9:30 and I feel like that's kind of on the earlier side. You will see people chatting away with their friends or just hanging out by themselves well into the evening. Also, the fact that cafes are so ubiquitous only makes them a stronger candidate for a great third place. I live in a small city and just around my area, there are about 10 cafes within a 5-minute walk. And I really don't think that's an exaggeration. It's really interesting to see how just one factor can make the difference between having somewhere to belong outside of home, outside of your work, and not. I personally feel very grateful to have this available to me, and it is my hope that everybody, wherever they are, can also find a third place that makes them very happy.
So Angie says several thousand miles across the world, cafes are vibrant and bustling until late in the evening. And spoiler alert, it's changed everything. Thank you again to Ivan, Anna Maria, Lynn, Angela, and Katie. There are third places everywhere. They still exist. They're still fighting for survival. And they need you just as much as you need them. Share your third places with each other. Take inspiration. Take a look at the corkboard. Talk to your strangers around you. And continue to hunt for your third place. And that's it. That's the end of the night. There are a few thank yous I have to quickly say. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Debbie Weeks-Bernard and the brilliant Shantae Joseph. Thank you to the Roundhouse team who worked with me to create this show. Tom, Maya, Akira, Alicia, Jess, Jack, and Lauren. Photography and videography, thank you so much to Gabrielle and Derek. And I want to thank Ben and Ellie and Lucas for listening to everything and supporting and keeping everything afloat while I get to create. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Floating Space Live episodes. I hope you enjoyed them. And if you want to learn more about what the Mayor of London's office is doing, or about Shantae Joseph and Strangers in the City, head to @floatingspacepodcast on Instagram for info and links. That's the end of season one. It means a lot if you leave a rating for the show wherever you get your podcasts, or if you want to leave some feedback, please do so in the comments or by sending us a DM on Instagram. I hope you'll join us next time through Floating Space.